Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Bewitching Book Tours, Blog Talk Radio. I am G.L. Ross, your host. Today's guest is award-winning author Colette Saucier from Southern Louisiana. Hello, Colette. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing very well. So you're down in Southern Louisiana. How's the weather down there?
Hot. I think that someone forgot to tell Louisiana that it was November.
I agree. I'm in Texas, and we're dealing with the same thing. I'm going, how do you dress for this insane weather when it's still hot, when it's almost Christmas time? So, hey, I want you to explain to me about Southern Girl Press. I saw that that's your publisher, and it fascinated me when I looked it up on the Internet. Is it down there in Southern Louisiana?
Here and in New York City. And so we pretty much support each other. And so, you know, the whole group of us, we edit for one another, a format for each other. And just it's more of a collective than a true publishing. That's why it's not called publishing. It's called press. And as more of a collective where we're all helping one another, we allow everyone to keep all of their own royalties. And so you know, that makes it a lot better than the indie presses that we actually had been using before, which that's how I met one of our authors. And then that press went out of business, and so we lost our small press. And at that point, my daughter and I had already started the collective.
Okay. That's great. I think it's so interesting that you guys organized that and got it all together. And I love it when authors support other authors, because we're all about reading fun, great books. And so I think, you know, there's enough of us out there and enough books to be read that we can all help each other out. When I was researching everything about you, I was fascinated by the fact that you've spent 20 years as a technical writer. What exactly were you doing?
I started off actually as a real estate appraiser, and so my technical writing was full-blown, detailed appraisals, narrative appraisals of property. And one time when I had first started out, and I was not a review appraiser, I had somebody else was a review appraiser, and I had said something in it about a property, and that the owner kept sheep for personal purposes. And then the review appraiser came over and was like asking me, okay, what are these personal uses that this man has for the sheep? So, eventually, I went to work in the software industry and wrote technical business analysis reports. And I was also asked to write up presentations and actually edit all of the publications before they went out. And pretty much everything was really technical. I would write technical business requirement reports eventually, and when I got transferred to the development department. And then, so I would say, okay, this is what it needs to do. This is what the software needs to do. And then I would hand it off to somebody else who would do the coding. And then I would check it and say, you know, whether or not they had fulfilled my requirements.
Love a woman in charge. That's great. Well, so how did you transition to writing romance novels about vampires?
I had started writing actually even in junior high school. And in high school, I had started writing romance novels, as sensual as a 14-year-old virgin can possibly write them. But they became actually quite popular, and they would make their way around the student body in in my all girls school, and you know, they enjoyed them. But then eventually, you know, things like college and children and marriage interrupted all of that, and I needed to, you know, get a job that paid. And so I didn't really get back into writing. Well, actually, this is kind of a crazy story, because my degree is in religious philosophy, and so I'm fascinated with all kinds of different global religions. And so I spent a month in Peru, and during that month in Peru, a week of it was with the Mapuches Indians in the rainforest, the Amazonian rainforest. And they're the cat people.
Wow.
They're the ones that stick the little, you know, whiskers in their nose and everything. And I participated in three ayahuasca ceremonies. And I don't know if you know, ayahuasca is considered the strongest hallucinogen known to man. And all I can say is that the plant made me do it, because when I was having this experience, you know, and this is completely legal in Peru, and, you know, it's a religious ceremony, like children were there, and the curandero was there, and with these palm fronds that he kept shaking. But what I came out through it was that the plant said that I needed to get back into writing. And so I had started writing something completely different, and then I have horrible insomnia, and so I had gone into my daughter's room, because I had read everything of mine, and she had that Pride and Prejudice and Zombies book, and I started reading it, and I hated it, because I'm kind of sort of an expert on Pride and Prejudice. I had done a lot of stuff with in college, and I was just, I hated it so much. But then she had this other book that was really good, and it was a trilogy, and everything was from Darcy's point of view. And I was like, you know what, this is really well written. I like this. And so, she lives in Manhattan, and I contacted her and said, you know, this is really good. I hate that zombie thing, but this is really great. And she said, yeah, you know, there are a lot of those out there. And so then all of a sudden I found myself reading, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was reading Jane Austen fan fiction. And because I didn't know such a thing even existed. I mean, my two eldest children had written fan fiction themselves, but it was always about Star Trek or, you know, Forever Night or something like that. And I just kind of went, why don't you write something original? But one thing that I could not find was a vampire adaptation that I liked, you know, because I hated the way the zombie thing was a mashup, because all he did was take the entire manuscript for Pride and Prejudice and then just stuck vampires and ninjas here. He didn't even remain faithful to Austen's language or anything. And so then after reading that other novel from Mr. Darcy's perspective, and I had always kind of thought of Darcy as, you know, like a Byronic figure, you know, for Lord Byron, that, you know, he's so aloof and proud and all of these other things. And plus, you know, he just has so many great characteristics that I thought lent so well to his being the Byronic hero, intelligent, or, you know, arrogant, cynical, you know, introspective. And I can't think of his first name, but Dr. Polidori, Lord Byron's physician, had written The Vampire, the very first book that came out, or short story rather, that conceived the idea of a gentleman vampire. Prior to that, they really were more like zombies. But he conceived the vampire, the gentleman vampire, molded on Lord Byron. And so I decided to write the book that I wanted to read. And because my daughter told me, hey, you know, why don't you write it? You can't find it, write it.
Right.
And
sure,
so with her encouragement, I went ahead and I started writing it, just a complete adaptation from Darcy's point of view, but I wrote it as though Jane Austen had always conceived his character as a vampire and just decided not to tell us. And that's why he's dark and brooding and why he always, you know, gets everything confused, misinterprets human emotions. He does not interact well with mortals. And so I just took that and writing it from his point of view, there was a lot of room for me to investigate into that because he is not in Pride and Prejudice very much at all. He only has like 12 or 13 scenes in which he says something, and most of the time it's two or three words. So I had a lot of room to expand on his character as a vampire. And that was in the first novel, Pulse and Prejudice.
Right.
That was the original.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I know we're going to talk about Dear Bloodies, Elizabeth, the new book, but Pulse and Prejudice is the first book in the series. So for the readers out there who haven't read Pulse and Prejudice yet, give us a little bit of a synopsis. I mean, you've told us some of it that it's about Mr. Darcy, but based on the vampire version of this with Pulse and Prejudice, kind of what happens? How's the love story mixed in? How does this progress?
So this is a complete adaptation. So one of I had to do that because my beta readers had either never read Pride and Prejudice or they, quote, had forgotten it because it had been so long. And so this is a standalone. You do not need to be familiar with Pride and Prejudice at all.
Okay.
So when I start off, when he arrives in Meryton, which is where Elizabeth Bennet lives, he has this attraction to her, and he does not think it could possibly be from his human side because she's so far beneath him on a social standing. And so he really, at that point, he despises his vampire side, that side of him, and he tries to suppress it, but he thinks that it's his vampire nature that is causing him to be attracted to her. And so then as time moves on throughout the story, he still just despises and hates this this nature that he has, this need for blood, and he tries to stay just with animal blood most of the time. But then eventually he keeps getting thrown into contact with Elizabeth, just like in Jane Austen's love story. And eventually he comes to realize that it's the human side of him. He really does love her. And so just kind of like a little twist on the actual novel that he resists and resists and resists his attraction to Elizabeth, and it's more complex though because he thinks it's just because he wants to drink her blood.
Now, when you were researching for this book, am I correct that you traveled through Europe and Britain for like 15 months researching this?
Well, I didn't spend the whole time in Europe, I wish. yes, I did go to Britain twice, and because I am married to an historian, and I knew that this had to be completely historically accurate because I had the risk that all of his historian friends were going to read it, and sure enough, they did, and one of his mentors read it, and she just told him that she just could not believe how great it was, that it was so historically accurate. And she's a big Jane Austen fan, so that was wonderful. But it is historically accurate down to the weather, because I actually moved the setting to the same year that Pride and Prejudice was published rather than when it was written, just so I could take advantage of all of these incredible things that were happening in the weather. And so the more I continued to research, I found all of those little tidbits and kind of incorporated that into the plot. So it's not like historical to the point where it's hitting people over the head with a lot of details, but it's just incorporated into it as part of the story. And yes, so I did, for 15 months, I researched all of the Regency era history, and I stayed true to the language of Jane Austen. There are no words in there that were not in use in 1814, and just try to say as close to my idea, which was, this is Jane Austen's take on Mr. Darcy. He was a vampire. She just forgot to tell us. And
now, have you always had an interest in vampires?
I don't know. I guess somewhat. You know, the vampire that I love is in Bram Stoker's Dracula with Gary Oldman. I just absolutely loved that motion picture. And in fact, when I do giveaways, a lot of time, like baskets and stuff, a lot of times I include that DVD in it because I just loved that adaptation. Mm-hmm. Obviously I'd read Dracula before, and of course the vampire, and even Lord Byron had written this poem called The Giaour, and it was the same year that Jane Austen released Pride and Prejudice, by the way. And it's a poem about a vampire, and I actually use it a little bit in Pulse and Prejudice. And I even have Lord Byron make a cameo in Pulse and Prejudice because I figured out that he and Darcy would have been about the same age. And so I figured out that they would have probably had the same type of education. And so I had, Darcy, a classmate of Lord Byron. And it was just kind of let that go into part of the plot as well. Just kind of an underside of it to add more depth to it.
Well, now in Dear Bloodiest Elizabeth, the setting is in New Orleans, and with the Creole Society and all. How does this transition happen? How do we end up in New Orleans, and how did you research the Creole Society?
That took me a long time because, well, first of all, my daughter said I had to write a sequel, the one that had encouraged me to write this one. And she said, you have to write a sequel. And so I wrote out a detailed outline of it and got her imprimatur on it. She gave it her blessing. And so then I started writing it. But, I had already done so much research on Regency England, and I could write that part relatively easily, and I already knew what I wanted to happen and how it was going to end. I use an outline like a map, and so it's like, okay, you want to get to this certain destination, but occasionally, the characters will go and take a detour in a different direction and
Absolutely.
Have to start writing it.
Absolutely.
And, but I did know most of what was going to happen. And so about half, they spend a lot of time in England at Pemberley, which is Mr. Darcy's estate, and in London. And they go back home to Hertfordshire, which is where Elizabeth is from, and have some interaction with her family. But eventually they're blackmailed by a Lutheran dwarf Dompierre into going to New Orleans. And so they end up going to New Orleans, and I spent so much time researching Creole society, and it was just absolutely fascinating. And the way that New Orleans, right out, this is immediately after the Battle of New Orleans, and just the way New Orleans was, it was still quite affected by the Louisiana Purchase. There was still a lot of distrust by the people in New Orleans proper to the Americans. And one of the reasons was because they had a really good yet delicate racial balance there. And they were concerned that the Louisiana Purchase, once the Americans took over, that that was going to mess up that racial balance. And because in other areas they had had like slave uprisings and everything, whereas in New Orleans it was 30%, you know, a third of the people were free people of color. And because it had been part of France, that had really affected how New Orleans interacted with people of color. Like, they ensured that they actually had rights. Even the slaves, if they were abused, could actually sue their masters, could take them to court. And that was not something that was, you know, part of the American way of doing things with their slaves. And plus, the people that had plantations, they would allow their slaves even to go to New Orleans and take jobs, and eventually they could go ahead and gain enough income so that they could buy their freedom. And that really was not something that was allowed. And it was even illegal for slaveholders to separate families. So the European influence, and that's what the Creole Society was, that has a totally different meaning today, but Creole Society at that time were the first and second generations of French and some people from Spain, people from France and Spain that had settled in the New Orleans area. Those were the Creoles. And so they were the Europeans. They were the whites. And then they had, so it was about a third of these Creoles, these white European descendants, and a third of free people of color, and a third slaves. And so everybody just kind of mixed up together. They all got along, especially the free women of color. They would open up, you know, haberdasheries and dress shops and all of these things. And so it was fascinating to learn all of that. Even living here almost all my entire life, I had no idea about any of this. It was just really new and an education for me.
Sure. Well, now, in Dear Bloody Elizabeth, I mean, let's get to the romance here for those romance readers out there. The newlyweds are in New Orleans, but apparently they're finding out the trials of being married to a vampire and a very jealous vampire who seems to have doubts because he just can't believe she loves him as he is. So tell us kind of what is happening in this book with our couple.
So anytime that you have a newlywed couple, there's going to be a period of adjustment. And in Dearest Bloodiest Elizabeth, we start off with the couple in their little honeymoon type period, but she has come to become the mistress of Pemberley, and she wants to do things that she thinks will make her husband more comfortable, like going ahead and serving him blood at dinner and things like that. And she doesn't understand, you know, she thinks that she's doing these things that will be helpful to him, and he kind of takes exception to some of this because it's embarrassing to him. But as the story progresses and he learns more about his power and what it allows him to do, that it allows him to protect his family because he has, you know, strength and speed, and as he goes along, he learns of other vampire characteristics as well. I mean, the words did not exist back then, but like psychokinesis and pyrol, you know, being able to set fires, whatever. But those words
right.
did not. You won't see those words in my novel because they didn't exist at the time. And so,
sure.
So he's kind of in a weird place because now he's finally accepting himself as a vampire, but he still can't quite understand that she accepts him as a vampire. And they go through this period where she actually even questions herself as to how is it that I can be with this man and love this man, and I know that he is capable of these terrible things. And the Lutheran dwarf Domvere that I mentioned earlier confronts her and tells her that her husband's soul is damned, and not only that, says that they're not truly even married because it's till death do they part, and you know, so he's already dead. And so like she says if he's not my husband, I'm not his wife, then what am I? And he says, you're the devil's concubine. And so that gets her to thinking that, you know, what is it about her? Is there something? So she's going through her own internal struggle because she loves him, but then she starts wondering if there's something evil within her that she can love someone who has a propensity to violence and has a propensity to be possibly evil. And so all of that is going into it, as well as he meets with another vampire who said that he had to leave his wife because she was human, and he just knew that it was wrong, that she needed to have a normal life, and she could never have a normal life with a vampire. And so then that causes Darcy some more self-doubts. And I will admit, one of my favorite Shakespeare's is Othello, and there is a lot of influence from that. It's kind of like, you know, Gone with the Wind meets Othello, and you throw in a vampire.
Wow, what a bit. Well, now, Pulse, for those our listeners out there who don't know, Pulse and Prejudice won numerous awards in 2013, and so I have no doubt that Dear Bloodiest Elizabeth is going to be absolutely just as fascinating, if not more. Where can our readers buy the book?
They can actually, it is available in bookstores, so sometimes you have to request it, but they will get you the hard copy, which is absolutely gorgeous. And of course, the ebook is available on all of the sites, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you know, iTunes. It's available everywhere that ebooks are sold. And also you can get the hard copy on Amazon as well, and probably other websites that I'm not aware of. It's Southern Girl Press, we work together, but then we have a different publisher, and that publisher puts it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have like a minute left, but tell us real quickly about your social media site, your website, where the readers can follow you.
Probably the best place to follow me is on my Facebook page, which is Colette Saucier Author. you might get bored with the pictures of my dog or you know, things that I cook. I do have a blog, but I have really been neglectful of my blog this year for a variety of reasons, and I do hope to get back into blogging more often because I particularly like supporting other authors and having them as guests on my blog.
Well, great. Well, we have really enjoyed talking to you today. I mean, you're absolutely fascinating, and I hope everyone will go out and grab both books if they haven't already read the first one. Grab both. Otherwise, grab hold of Dear Bloody Elizabeth and conclude with this fascinating story. I wish you the very best. I hope you get some cooler weather in Louisiana and have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And we really appreciate you being our guest today. So, ladies and gentlemen,
thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Take care now.
All right. Bye-bye.